And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, John A. from Laguna.
Hi, my name is John Ackerlin, and I'm an alcoholic. I am enthusiastic about this program and very grateful for this way of life. It's terrific most of the time. And I like to thank you for the invitation. And I was here only for 15 minutes. And I already bothered the secretary here, you know. I made 2 minutes overtime on my birthday, you know. You are doing your job, and I love you. And I have no problem with you at all. I just want you to... You might have a problem with me. It doesn't matter. We don't run, and we are nothing short in Alcoholics Anonymous. We serve, and it's equal partnership. I love the first speaker. It's a formula for living, and I love your talk. I wish you could talk a little longer. I will hear you again, I know. Thank you. You know, you know, very few people live to be 45 years sober. It's a true, absolutely true. You know, Chuck Chamberlain, I lived next to him for 25 years in Laguna Beach, and he was 84 years old, he was 38 years sober, and he was a beautiful man. He probably helped more people in the Alcoholics Anonymous than anybody else. His 6 tapes that he sold more than any other tape all over the world. And his book that was the 6 tapes they made into book form sells all over the world, $6 delivered. Nobody makes the money at it. He said, I don't want to have any money for my book, because this is a gift of God. I can't take credit for it. He was a beautiful man. You know, I tell you how old that is, 45 years. Many years ago, I was invited to Rye, New York, and Ray O'Keefe, a superior judge, invited me to speak on Saturday night. It was a bicentennial meeting. I came up there. Lois Wilson was there. She was the co-founder's wife. And Jim Burwell was there. He was the guy that wrote the chapter in Gnostic and Big Book. It was a big deal. That kind of aged me a little bit. Some of you look a little suspicious. You know, I lived in Laguna Beach for 36 years. And the first year I went to 7 meetings a week. Then I went to 5 meetings a week. Ever since. A lot of meetings. But that's 24 hours a day. 2 hours I go to my meetings. And for the rest I live my life and take care of my family and take care of my work. Most of my life I worked 8-10 hours a day. Now, a few years ago, we had to sell our house. I live next to Sir Chamberlain. I had that beautiful view that you have heard him. He talks about the main beach in Laguna and the Heisel Park and so on. And I live just... I could throw a rock on his house, you know. My wife goes to Al-Anon, to Elder Chamberlain's Al-Anon meeting that she started 49 years ago. And my wife, she had her 44th birthday in Al-Anon this last Christmas. And and the first time she should have a birthday in Al-Anon, I thought I was going to be funny. So I said, how do you count their birthdays in Al-Anon? When you first came in or when you actually surrendered? And she said it would be counted from the first time we kicked you son of a bitches out of the house. So she's still winning. Not out. I met her when she was 17 years old in Stockholm, Sweden, during the Second World War. And last 2nd of April, we had been married 60 years. We have been together for 63 years. I was nip and tuck a few times. But so it is. You know, I'm in the building business. I've been in the building business for over 50 years, 54 years. And we left that beautiful house a few years ago and moved to Laguna Woods, 4 miles inland. But the taxes were so high and I'm so old, you know. So I got this beautiful condominium in Laguna Woods. Two bedroom, two bathrooms, and a 30-foot living room and a 30-foot balcony, and looking out over a creek. It's just beautiful. And now I work full time and I'm 86 years old and I have a 30-year loan. The guy who approved the loan, if he would take an honest inventory, he would realize that optimism is one of his defects of character. Needless to say, I love birthdays in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not natural for alcoholics to be sober. It's a real big deal. So happy birthday and ship day to you guys. It's terrific. And I talk to newcomers. I love the feelings in these rooms with our newcomers. And I like being a newcomer myself. I like to remember when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was not good news, you know. And you know, you newcomers, what is this? Most of you don't want to be here. I didn't want to be here. I didn't think I was alcoholic. You know, I had a conception of an alcoholic was somebody to live on Skid Row. I lived in a beautiful home with a swimming pool. I had 3 automobiles and an English bulldog. I had a dapper gray Arabian horse down the street that I rode every day after work, and I had exquisite living. And I found out after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, 10% of alcoholics live on Skid Row, the rest live in better homes. It's a very expensive habit to drink like we do, you know. And so you have to make a lot of money. See. And you know, I came in, I had $36,000 worth of unpaid bills. And it was a mess. You know, I'm living in sobriety. You see this watch? It's a Rolex watch, solid gold. I just want you newcomers to see that. It's called an Oyster Perpetual Superlative Chronometer. You know, you buy a solid gold watch today, a Rolex, it costs $24,000. It's good for 300 feet below sea level. This one here, it's good for 1,500 below sea level. And what's unique about it, it's 43 years old. And it winds itself. And it looks like brand new. I cost $3,000 when Karen bought it for me. Next year she bought me the solid gold, you know. And it's worth more than that president was today due to the fact of the age group, you know. And so I just want you to know, I love success stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been rich and I've been poor, and I prefer to be rich. I am much more spiritual when I have money. For the record, my grandfather died from alcoholic delirium in 1908. He lived in the 2,000-acre place out of Stockholm. They were breeding racehorses. Beautiful, beautiful place. But he died from alcoholic delirium. My father had a problem with his liver in 1927, and nobody knew anything about his illness then. He was a giant of a man. He radiated vitality. Women adored him. Men envied him. But he died 3 years later. And he only weighed 130 pounds when he died. He didn't want to die at all. And he didn't have much of a chance. You know. Now, they had no medication. You know. He drank a quart of aquavit, 100% proof liquor, to stop the pain. When he died, he weighed 130 pounds and he was yellow and green and he had screamed, "I don't want to die." It was terrifying. I was 8 years old then. And my father, my older brother, he graduated from 3 universities, spoke 6 languages fluently. He carried a Swedish flag in the Olympics 3 times. And he lived in a castle out of Stockholm and he was married to a very beautiful girl. He married my girlfriend. I had a little problem with that for a while. Of course, now I'm glad he did, you know. He drank like I drank and he blew, though. You know, here he was. He living in this place, made 150 grand a year, you know. He represented Austria, Vienna, and Sweden, the Semper Trouble factory for all the Scandinavian countries. It was fantastic. But he drank. So his wife divorced him. The last 18 years of his life, he lived in a little room in Stockholm. It cost 15 bucks a month to live in. You know. I wrote him a letter one time. Page and a half what I used to be like. And 3.5 pages about all the wonders that has happened to me since I sobered up in Alcoholics Anonymous and found a way to live. I got a card from him and said, "I'm sorry to hear about all your problems." You know. I mean, to him, that was a headache. He didn't want to work anymore. I flew to Stockholm in 1978 to spend a couple of weeks. He sat in that little hole. He had this little room, a 2-foot closet, a little steel bed with a thin mattress like that, and a little table at the window, and a chair, and a 10-inch TV set. And I said, "Matthew, why don't you go back to work?" And I said, "That bitch, she ain't going to get any money from me." And I said, "You know, she has lived in the castle for 14 years with your kids, and you still live in this goddamn cubbyhole." He said, "I'm a very humble person." Talk about arrogance. I invited him out here. He was with me for a month. We lived in Laguna Beach. He met all our friends, went to AA meetings with him, and Lynn Wilder one night, many of you know him, he invited us to him, Monarch Beach. They had a beautiful home, and he come home to me after the meeting, and 114 people or so came to his big house there in Monarch Beach, and my brother was there. 6'4", handsome as hell, dark and mysterious. And I was about 20-some young women in AA, 22, 32 years old. They were fascinated by this guy. Lynn gave him a tall highball glass of scotch, you know, and my brother stood out for about 3 hours, and they were up around there hugging him and kissing him and rubbing up, you know, and he had a great time. And last night before he should fly back to Sweden, I said, "What do you think about this?" He said, "You don't understand, I don't want to quit. It's the only thing that's real in my life. When I sit down drinking a fifth of whiskey every night and think about when I was on top of everything," I said, "I understand." He flew home. He died 11 months later in the prime of his life. Alcoholism. My younger brother was 8 years younger than I was. You know, and 30 years ago, he went to Scripps twice in La Jolla. 30 years ago. said, "Carl, your liver is shot. You can't drink no more." He's still drinking 30 years later. You know, he lives 15 minutes away from me. And his wife sings in the choir in the church. And he collects. He has to drink every 2-3 hours a day to live. He doesn't want to have anything to do with me. It's a stigma to be an alcoholic. Alcoholism. It's a tragedy. So it is. You and I are the lucky ones because of the evidences in these rooms. You know, 90% of alcoholics never come to an AA meeting. They don't know that it's a way to live without alcohol. You and I are the lucky ones. You know, I'm going to share my story. First, my father, you know, he was an aristocrat, vain and proud and arrogant. But he was also a loving person, but I was in violence. And thanks to our program, I've been able to deal with that. 99 out of 100 meetings I go till we finish with the Lord's Prayer. And there's a line that says, "Forgiven as I forgive those who trespass against me." And I assure you there was stuff in my inventory I wish I could be forgiven about. And then we can't have two stand-ups here. I'm supposed to be forgiven. I'm supposed to have an opportunity for a new life. But anybody did something for me, justice for them, whatever you want to go. It's an important point. If we don't address this issue, we will come in as victims and we will remain victims, and that will interfere in our own recovery. That's why I bring it up. You know, and you know, I'm so old, you know. I come into these rooms and I have some murder friends in this room. I love them immensely. And you were never seen before. In a very short while, you will know me very intimately. And that's just one of the neat things in AA, that we can know each other on that level. So I come into this room, and as an old timer, said, "Oh, him again." You know, that's what happens when you're old. A bunch of years ago, I was invited to Flagstaff in a conference. And the guy who invited me, he was old like myself, like all gentlemen here that's sober, 34 years. He said, I asked him, "You know, you invited him here 7 years ago, 11 years ago, 19 years ago, and 27 years ago. I said, why do you invite me again?" He said, "I wanted to hear you one more time before you die." Isn't that beautiful? I'm probably the most famous substitute speaker on the West Coast. Happened long ago. You know, sometimes the circuit speakers, they are invited to two different locations the same weekend. And Dr. Paul, you call him, God rest his soul, he was only in 1 year sober. He was already a circuit speaker, you know. That doctor was very notorious, you know, and he was invited, and he was circuit speaker after a year of sobriety. And he was invited to Vancouver, Canada, the same weekend, and his wife Max, God rest her soul, she wanted to go to Hawaii. And by the way, my wife Karen, she was Max's sponsor in Al-Anon, you know. So when I want to go to Hawaii, she said, "Why don't we send you on to Vancouver?" That was my first big deal, you know. And I came up, there were 4,500 people in that conference, you know. And Corky Berg was a guy he met me at the airport and took me to a hotel. And Friday afternoon down there, everybody milling around, 4,500 people, you know. And oh, wow, what a buzz it was going on. And we are standing there talking, and this lady came up to Corky and said, "How are you?" And he said, "I'm really good. How are you?" You know. And she looked at him and said, "You don't really remember me, do you?" He said, "Sure, honey, but I'm rather busy with this gentleman right now." So she left. I said, "Corky, she wanted to talk to you. You don't have to babysit me. Everybody are friendly. Go and talk to her." So he left 10 minutes later, came back and said, "That's the goddamnest thing I've ever experienced." I said, "What happened?" And he said, "I came over there and said, 'Hi, how are you?' And she said, 'You don't remember me, do you?'" And he said, "Sure, honey, what meeting did I meet you at?" And she said, "For God's sake, man, I was your second wife." You know? A little bit of a blackout, I suppose. You know, when my wife and I, right after the war, we came over to America in 1948. We were legal immigrants. And, you know, those days when we came in, everything was on government contract. You couldn't get a job. You know, if you weren't a citizen, hard to get a job. You know, I was very spoiled, came from wonderful circumstances, you know, in Sweden, you know, I have $1,000 suits and ballet shoes and well spoiled. The last night before we left for America, I paid Clarence Taylor $3,000, you know, and mine was the same, and we were very well off. Sweden had no dollars after the war. We came out here to Los Angeles, we had $815 to start a new life. You know, and I wanted to come to America. You know, that Sweden was at that time a large socialistic country. I paid 60% in taxes. You made 30 grand a year, you paid 18,000 in taxes. And I had always loved America, and I had a chance to come here. So we came here, we started out with $800. I pumped gas in Beverly Hills for 3.5 years to make a living. And, I'm not the gasoline pump on Greenland, but that's what I did to make a living. And then I got this job with a door factory. That was an opportunity for me. So I got this job, and my boss was alcoholic, and he wanted to have somebody to drink with. I never drank before. You know, when my father died, I had promised my grandmother I was never going to drink, so I didn't drink. So this is 1952. And so I started to drink. And the damnedest thing happened to me right off the bat. I couldn't quit. You know, I never drank. I'm 31 years old. I drank a fifth of booze from day one. For 2 years, I was never drunk, never hungover. I just felt good. It was wonderful. You know, I had a lot of emotional problems, you know. My dad died when I was 8. My little sister died when he was 5. When I was 5, and my mother died before I started to drink. You know, I had a lot of tragedies, you know. But so I was emotionally really screwed up. Alcohol was a wonder to me. And you know, I sell doors. I sold so many doors in 1 year that they gave me 1/3 of the stock of the company. You know, here I'm just a little immigrant, you know. I own my own door factory. I own 30% of a door factory. I tell you how it was in the beginning. You know, I drank all day and had a wonderful time. I was never drunk, never hungover for 2 years. I just felt good. I came home after work at 4 o'clock. I filled up my bathtub with hot water. I mixed myself a Jigo martinis, dry martinis, 4-to-1, you know. And, you know, I slid in the tub down, lit a candle and inhaled, you know. And I lay down in that tub and I smoked my Camel and I drank my martini and I spit it out, the pimento, you know. You know. I said, you know, this is really class, you know. I mean, look at me. I've been here just for 6 years. I own my own door factory. That was terrific. And, you know, I drank right at 1 o'clock. I was dealing with the big developers. S&S Construction was the biggest builder in Southern California in America at that time. They built 1,000 homes a year. And I had sent, you know, we were the first people to manufacture pre-hung door openings. So I had sent him a proposal, and I was into his main office, big desk, 30-foot desk, and a bay window, and he sat down looking at my proposal, you know, and I had been drinking over 2 in the afternoon, and I felt good. I've been drinking all day. And he said, "This is really an interesting concept." So I said, "Well, Mr. Chappelle," I said, I think that we should really stick together." I said. And he said, "I had no idea that you were Jewish." I said, "Right now I am." You know. You And he just laughed and signed a contract with $300,000. Get the hell out of here and give me a good service. You know. I had the best. You know. Then my wife, I had 3 years of drinking, my wife ran out of humor. She said, "Yoni, if you don't stop drinking, I go back to Sweden." I said, "Don't do this to me, Karen. You have no idea how well I'm doing. Go out and buy yourself another dress. Don't bug me about this. Not the booze. I never felt any better in my life." So I drink to the letter, and then she comes to me and said, "If you don't stop drinking, you have to move out." So I stopped drinking. I didn't want to be kicked out. Then 2 weeks later, I hadn't had to drink for 2 weeks. The things were worse at home. We still screamed at each other. I said, "Look, I haven't had a drink for 2 weeks. We still screamed. We don't get along no more. It's not the booze." And then, so on and on it goes, you know. And then I want to have a divorce. I said, "Karen, wait for 90 days. I close up this job and I have a much better deal. I get you the best attorney. Please wait." So she waited 90 days. You know. And I kept going. When I was into 3 years of drinking, I was up to 2/5 of whiskey a day. The last 10 months I drank, you know, then I came a discovery that the last 2 years I drank, I got sick in the morning when I drank whiskey, so I discovered codeine cough medicine. So I drank codeine cough medicine in the morning. I woke up and calmed my stomach down so I could drink whiskey. What a boy, this is it, you know. And you know, and then I started to get the shakes when I stopped drinking. Then 2 shots of booze stopped the shakes, so I could function and work. So now I have to con myself in. I have to drink all the time, otherwise I can't go to work. Now that goes on for a while. The next episode, when you drink like I did, you know, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and I sat in my bed straight up, and I looked in front of me, and this big white snake came out of the wall. Yeah, it came right out of the wall. It was snow white, had 3 black eyes. This big in diameter, on his face, he was 23 feet long. And he came slowly across the room and stopped in front of my face and started to hiss at me. I could even smell him. That kind of paralti. He smelled like death, you know. And I sat down and said to myself, "You know, I haven't had a drink for 3 days, so it can't be the booze, you know." "Anybody here had hallucinations, or are you all a bunch of high-bottom drunks?" And my experience with that snake was this, that the closer he came, the more I screamed. And the screams in my head reached such a crescendo, it was eventually like my brain exploded for my own screams, and then I fell backwards unconscious. That's how it was for me. Karen told me in the morning, she said, "Something strange happened this morning around 4 o'clock. She said, "You sat straight up, looked in front of you for quite a while, and then you said, 'Hee!'" The third time that happened to me, I said, "This only happens when I stop drinking. I will never ever stop drinking again." One night I made love to her, but she wasn't even there. That's kind of tricky. She was actually laying 2 feet away from me now. And she said, "What are you doing over there?" And I said, "I beg your pardon." When she realized what was going on, she started to laugh at me. I started to cry. I felt it was so humiliating to laugh at the guy who was doing his best. In the morning, I'd been out in the kitchen. I'd had my codeine cough medicine and my whiskey, and she met me in the hallway. She said, "Well, good morning, lover boy." And you know, I love Laughters in Alcoholics Anonymous. That to me is a spiritual experience, because everything you and I laugh about here was a tragedy when it happened. But when you and I can laugh about that whole mess, it makes it possible for us to forgive ourselves and change. It's very much part of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I'd like to tell you something. I have no opinions in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just share my experiences. That's what we are supposed to do here. You know, I hear sometimes people say that I have to learn to love myself before I can love anybody else. That was my problem in the first place. Love myself. Ugh. You know, I mean, if I wasn't the center of attention, I wouldn't even play. No. I'm grateful that I'm me, because I can change me. But that other stuff is just therapeutic nonsense, you know. So, Jesus. I went to church. You know, I had 12 years, 2 hours a day of religious education in Sweden. I learned that Lutheran church. I learned a lot about the fear of God. And here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have learned about the love of God. It's fantastic. It's a very healing here. You know, thou shalt not. If you think that you have done it, then you burn. You know, Jesus. I went to church, and what minister said, you have to ask God to help you. I said, Walter, you're a good man, I'm not. You don't talk to your wife the way I talk to mine when she bugs me about my drinking. God doesn't want to have anything to do with me. I try that stuff. So that gentleman, he read a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he found out that him and I relaxed identification, that I had to find my bottom further down alone. He even suggested a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what it meant, Alcoholics Anonymous. He suggested after a while, he said, you have to go to a psychiatrist. I spent $2,000 with his doctor. That wasn't anything he said to me that my wife didn't tell me for free 3 times a day. That wasn't anything he said to me either that wasn't the truth. Everything was the truth. One time he said, you know what's wrong with you, John? And I said, tell me. And he told it all. My emotional problem and all that stuff. And when he was through, I said, doctor, you're absolutely right. And that's why I drink. I can't stand myself the way I am, you know. I'm different. So it is. The last episode of before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was a Sunday morning at Thrifty Mart in Anaheim. I came in there, I was drunk, weighed 246 pounds, and I was picked up trying to steal a pint of liquor for $3.57. You know, I looked terrible, bloated, and I couldn't defend myself. I stood up and whimpered, what has happened to me? You know, look where I came from. You know, we had two nurses that dressed and bathed us till we were 12 years old. It was exquisite, sir. That morning in Anaheim, I looked exactly like a person who has to steal a pint of liquor to live. That's how it was. The next day, I came into one of my accounts in Anaheim, Dykstra and Drake. They're building apartment buildings. And I came in there, and the secretary said, I saw you in the market yesterday. You know, I'm glib. I didn't defend. I just said a four-letter word and walked out of there. That's how it was. The next day, Karen stood down and looked at me and she said, you know, for years, because of the children, we have stayed together. But now, because of them, we have to part. Either you go down and try that thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to mount. That's the only reason I went down to the Alana Club. I came in, there was an old lady behind the coffee bar, said, do you have a drinking problem? I said, no. Get along famously with it. Can you do something for my wife? She's crazy. Tell you another thing. If I had known how sick I was, I would never have stayed. Stopping drinking wouldn't have fixed that, I assure you. The second day it happened to me, I came up in the morning, I drank my stuff and polished off a pint of Seagull 7 on my down to the Yolona Club and came in there at 8 o'clock, and I called my wife and tell her I'm here already. And then I proceeded to tell them why I couldn't be an alcoholic, and I have all these things. And that was the guy who said, that son of a bitch will never make it, you know. And then I went out and had four double Maltinis for lunch and came back and she started again. And then it happened. And I said, call my wife and tell her I'm here for the second time just to show how sincere I was. Then his voice in the back came and said, Yoni, why don't you come home with me and let us talk? I said, okay. It was so pathetic. And you know, there's a pamphlet here, Members I View of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alan McInnes wrote, he was a screenwriter. The finest pamphlet you can read when it comes to what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And among other things, Alan McInnes said, the first miracle that happens in an Alcoholics Anonymous is this. Wherever you and I come in, they say, you know it's wrong with you. And here in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, they come in, hi, you know what's wrong with me? Come in here, sit down and have a cup of coffee or home. And we don't put them on the defensive. It's a beautiful thing. So Charlie sits down and tells me his story. And I realize he's worse than I was. And he depended more than I did on it. And he was sober. I said, you really were that bad and you don't have to drink no more? So then I said, you don't have... When I stopped drinking, I got the shakes and I had these terrible things happen to me. And then he said this, you will only shake for 4 or 5 days and then you never have to shake again as long as you live. That's when I broke and I asked, show me what to do. I was in a meeting that night and when the red portion of chapter 5 that we heard here this evening, I said, please God help me that it's a special. And it wasn't a big deal. You know, I thought a spiritual experience would be something like, yes, John, what can I do for you, you know? But my thoughts were, perhaps after all this, there's a way for me too. I came home that night and I said to Karen, it happened to me tonight. I don't have to drink anymore. And she said, your eyes look different. I haven't had a drink since, or any coding or anything. It's incredible. So I had 10 days of sobriety. And I'd been in a meeting. And I blurted out in that 10 days of sobriety, I said, you don't understand, but I feel so goddamn guilty. And that was an old timer said, the reason you feel so guilty is because you're guilty. Then you have to live with that. So now I can accept, yeah, I'm guilty, but I can't drink no matter what the day of the time. Now that's working. So then, when we had the Lord's Prayer after the meeting, I stood out. Why did I tell on myself? Now they all know. And then the next miracle happened. I stand out alone after the prayer, and this guy walks up to me. I never saw him before. He puts his arm around me, and he whispers, Johnny, everything is going to be all right. And I believed him. I haven't walked alone since. A beautiful thing what happens in these rooms. You all know I was 2 weeks sober. I came home after the meeting. I said, something has happened in these rooms. Something has happened in these rooms. You all know I hope you stay long enough to have that experience. I still get the goosebumps. It's fantastic. I had 60 days of sobriety. I'm up, and I have 60 days of sobriety, and we have 60 days of sobriety. Those days, sometimes we said, come home to me after the meeting, and have a Coke and a cup of coffee, you know. And so... So 60 days, and that was about 14 guys came home to my house, you know. And we talked about what Mary said, and Fran said, and Bill said, and oh, what a terrific meeting. Then my wife, she was angry as hell, you know, came over with this cardboard box and put it on the living room table. Now, all these bills, $36,000 worth of bills, you know. And she said, yeah, I know, you're absolutely freaking terrific. What are we going to do with these? And there was one guy who said, they can't kill you and they can't eat you. And I said, did you hear that? So Charlie said, my sponsor said, you got to go to work. I said, we want nothing? Johnny, you got to go to work. You have four kids to bring up. You got to make money. I said, I can't do it, Charlie. 8 o'clock the next morning is my front door ringing. Come on, we're going. You know, he drive me down to Dachshund and Drake, the apartment builder, where the secretary had sent me being picked up for stealing a pantaloon. I didn't have to tell Charlie about that I was a thief. He said, get in there, give them a bid. I come in down, Helen looks disgusted. I said, may I give you a bid? Over there in the corner. So I went over there in the corner, I had frames, jams, doors, walls, finished lumbers, and I went over to be two apartment buildings, 8-unit apartment buildings. Came over to her desk and I said, Helen, thank you for letting me give you a bid. And then she looked up at me and her face completely changed. It became tranquil. And she said, oh God, you aren't drinking anymore. I have 60 days. And she said, God bless you, John. I have a brother-in-law. He has 2 years on the program. You're going to be fine. I came out to Charlie, sat in my car, you know. And I said, you know, I gave them a bid. He said, let's go down to the club and have a cup of coffee. So we go down to the have a cup of coffee. I stood over in my mug and drank coffee. I said, you know, I gave them a bid. And Charlie said, let us do it again. I said, what are you talking about? Come on. We made 2 calls in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, 3 in the morning. Charlie stayed with me for 90 days until I had enough guts to make calls on my own. And that happened to me when I was new in AA. We go through hell with you if you stay sober and come to a meeting. We really do, you newcomers. You don't have to do nothing alone anymore. And then I had 6 months of sobriety. I'm up early, I go to work early. My wife was angry as hell. She said, yeah, before you had the booze as a crutch, now you have those goddamn meetings. Are you that kind of a weakling who can't stand on your own 2 feet? I said, I suppose so. I go over to my meeting, I will pre here for an hour and a half, and I come home. I should have, you know, and I should have dinner before my meeting. That's 25 phone calls about the people I owe the money to. I had no income, $36,000. I couldn't sign a check, get off my back. And so I called my sponsor, Charlie. I said, Charlie, they want my money. And he said, no, they want their money. So I went on a budget. And I worked all day, stayed sober every day, and I went to a meeting every day, and it took me 3.5 years, and I bought money orders twice a month, and it took me 3.5 years to pay back that $36,000. When I paid back that $36,000, there was no resentment because I had bought my freedom. It's very important, this thing, the financial amends. See, you know, that day, you know, so I go to the meeting and I come home, and I'm supposed to thank God for my sobriety day. I lay down and meditate. I said, God, what a terrible day I've had. What an absolutely terrifying day I've had. And then I'd say, yes, but I didn't drink. And I said, what's going on? I used to get drunk a whole lot less. And then it begins, because then we start to realize this thing called sobriety is mine. It's my own. It's the only decent thing that has happened to me a long time. It must be a gift or something. Then begins the consistency of our living, and then we add to them. From now on, everything is God's business, good and bad. And if God is part of the best of it is just a period within a period. And when we have gone through that period, we realize where we have gone through, and it all starts to fall in place. So this thing here called sobriety, that's the big deal here. Many people say, when will my ship come in? This is the ship. It begins and ends with sobriety. You've got to start somewhere. It came then to me that at least I'm doing this right. Then Charlie comes to me about the inventory. He said, you got to take the inventory. I said, it means no difference. He said, if you don't take your inventory, you ain't going to stay sober. Okay, I'm going to prove to you, means. So I rewrite my inventory. So I called Charlie and I said, come down, we take the fifth step. Like your lovely lady said here tonight. But my minister thought that that'd be nice to me when I was drinking. My sponsor sat down and I read my inventory. Took 50 minutes to read my inventory. And I had that bad attitude. When I finished reading it to them, something happened. I had definitely a feeling that I had fulfilled the contract for sobriety. I wouldn't have to get drunk anymore. I never counted on that. It's a big deal. I also had a feeling that God has forgiven me for what I took my family through. I hadn't counted on that. And then, like this lovely said, what happened third was I belonged somewhere. There were people that was just like me. It's a beautiful deal. That's the inventory. If any of you sit here and wonder about the inventory, I give you a shortcut. First, write down the four things you have decided not to tell anybody, even under severe torture. It will save you 62 pages of writing. Now, it's resentments. What do I have to find? 9:25? Huh? Okay. You got to bury me. I got to give you some help before I go home. You know, I pay my own way and I don't get paid for this. So anyhow, I this is history. And this is probably the last time I speak down here. So just bury me. It's not a waste of time. So then resentments. That was my older brother. He hated me with a passion. He was 2 years older than I was. He was enormous. He was 6'4". He weighed 200 and some pounds. And I was little. And he used to punch me out. I rolled under the dining room table and pretended I fainted so he wouldn't hit me anymore. I was no match for him. And he brilliant, had a photographic mind. He looked like, you're so stupid, devil ass way. I have no confidence in myself. And he was a professional water polo player. I was out in the ocean in Sweden, down there where we lived, and 15 feet depth, and he drowned me. It's a terrifying thing to drown. When you hang down, you have to inhale and breathe in water instead. You feel like it's such an excruciating pain that you think your eyeballs are going to kick out of your head. It's terrible. I hung suspended. I couldn't move my limbs. I heard my father's voice talking to me the other side, But that's how it was. My brother picked me up and took me up on the sun. I lay down and coughed out the water and lay down and wept. Why does he hate me so much? So I'm sitting and working on my resentment. I said, how can I forgive him? Am I some sort of a second-class citizen that can just walk over me? I said, I forgive you and I love you. There's got to be more than that. And then I started to think, and it was just like I saw a film. When we were little, he was 5 years old, I was 3 years old. And my father, all father, favored me. When I was 3 years old, I assure you, I was absolutely adorable. I had golden, I was beautiful. And he was obese, and he was not the lap baby. And I could see his eyes. What about me? And then I realized I was in the way. He needed more love than I did. That's the whole problem with us. And then I sat down that night and talked to God, and I realized, my brother, he had one obsession in his life, which was to get approval from our father. He couldn't get it because he died when he was 9. He took gymnastics. He became one of the finest athletes in Sweden. He was so successful and lived at the castle. Just my father grew up all his life, and he still had the obsession to get the approval. He couldn't get it because he was dead. And the next day I hadn't heard from my brother for 15 years, and I got a letter, paragraph for paragraph, what I had been thinking about, he had written down. Do you remember when we should honor our father's wife when we were 12 and glorify his name, and this is what I have done? So what did I do? I wrote him a little note, and I said, "Dear Baptist, if our Father wouldn't have been alive today, he would have taken you in his arms and said, 'You have succeeded beyond my greatest expectation. Your loving brother, John,' and I mailed it. I lost my inferiority complex. You know. And I didn't say to him, 'I forgive you for drowning me.' I didn't play God. You know, there's a step that accept him to do so would ensure that another step for that step is about. I just made amends to him how I had interfered in his life. We clean our side of the street, no strings. You know, after that, my brother wrote me every 60 days and told me what he was doing. And he couldn't understand that we could have such a fine relationship. And then he died from alcoholism in the prime of his life. We were friends for all this year. That was resentment. And now comes the God business. You know, we pray in the morning. You know, I pray in... Well, 7 o'clock in the morning, the superintendent called me from the outside to interrupt me. So I just had a quick prayer in the morning to lock in. And I said, "Thank you, God, for being with me today. I know this to the fact that I'm trying to please you does, in fact, please you. I got to go now. I'll be very busy. I got to go now." And I locked in, you know. So then at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I went down to the beach in Laguna. I had my 10th and 11th step with God. And I did that for 3 months, and I realized that this is just a bickering with God. I just tell him what I want him to do for me. So I changed it. I took my 10th and 11th step at the beach, and then the next day I called Charlie and I said, "Let me tell you what I talked to God about yesterday." So when I talked loudly to him, what I talked to God about, when I talked to Charlie, it didn't sound so good. I was not so convinced that I was right all the time. And you see, so then one day I says to Charlie, "What do you do in a situation like this?" He said, "I tried it this way, it worked, didn't work. I tried it this way and it worked better." And I immediately thought, the way I tried to handle it is a lot more sophisticated. I tried it this way and it worked better. You see, when you talk to God through your sponsor, you have no secrets. And there's a line in the big book that says, "We are as sick as our secrets." It's true. It's a beautiful thing. There's no freedom and no happiness, and things are baffled on and on and on. It is fantastic to have that relationship. You know, you and I, never have we talked to God when he said, "Yes, John, you're right on," or "You're wrong." And, you know, but talk to God through your sponsor. You have no secrets. And let us face it, there were things I talked to God about that I didn't want anybody else to know because I wouldn't come out so good. So it is. Now, so now my sobriety is right. My AA life is good. My work goes better. My kids come home from school. "Hi, Dad, can we talk?" Now the kids are in place. Every day you and I stay sober, life is getting better in spite of us. And there have been days in my life, the only thing that was right that day, I didn't drink that day. It's worthwhile to fight for. Karen didn't believe I was going to stay sober. It took 3 years. You know, and I'd been on the wagon before. Every time we began, I always went back to drinking again. So she didn't dare to be friendly with me. 3 years later, she comes and says, "Johnny, it wasn't always your fault." I said, "Well, now I can die, you know." So what is it that's going on in these rooms? Chuck and Esther showed us every time they went to a meeting, love with no condition, love with no condition. You and I can be who we are and what we are in spite of your love. There's nothing like it on the face of the earth. You and I can be who we are and what we are in spite of your love. It's a beautiful thing. You know, and I have this way, I think this, that we know so much about one another. We hear. I think this, there is a trust that goes in between men and men and so on. The trust, we know strings to it. It's a beautiful thing, you know. So I'm going to say how, you know this, you study, become a doctor. 2.5 hours in 4 years, they have alcoholism. Number one killer, second contributor to insanity. No, it's incurable. That's what we are dealing with. The only thing you and I can live with is not drink a day at a time. So we are dealing with the emotional part here. You know, I mean, what did I used to be like? I never fitted in. I couldn't function. If I wasn't the center of attention, I wouldn't even play. I always wished I was somebody else. And thanks to this way of life, you and I and many people in this room, to do this thing and helping others. We live out there, we function, we have a purpose. I'd be so bold to say that many of we live out there like we don't have the illness. Tell that to a guy who have heart and cancer and not a fatal disease. You and I are no victims. You and I, thanks to this way of life, have an opportunity to participate in life and living. Nobody have the breaks that you and I have with such a serious sickness as alcoholism. You know. So, how can it be that you and I can sit in a stadium with 84,000 people and feel alone and different? It's a symptom of alcoholism. We overfeel in all directions. When I feel bad, I feel really bad. And when I feel better, good, I feel like I'm better than Jesus Christ. You know. And then I have my 10th and 11th step one night. I'm just like they are, and they are just like I am. And if they can do what I can do, I'm part of something instead of... It's just as hard for him as it is for me. It's a fair competitive deal. We are part of something. It's a beautiful thing. No, we can't go overtime here. Life's the old time is crazy, you know. I give you an... Yeah, all right, don't worry. 1.5 minutes, okay? You know, there's a guy named Bob Lemke. He's a full-blooded German. And I had a little problem with the Germans during the war. He talks funny. He was born here, had more of an accent than I have. He must practice every night. He was 12 years sober. I had his birthday. I was supposed to speak in Glennon at birth. And he's one of those staunch old timers that you can't save any souls after 10, you know. You know, 10 o'clock he sat at the exit door. And he screamed, "John, for God's sake, it's 10. I said, "Lemke, this is only an AA meeting. We ain't marching into Poland tonight, you know." Bob is a great guy. We are dear friends. The last Christmas, he had 44 years of sobriety. He helped a lot of people. He's a great guy. It's one of the beautiful things. So what is this thing? You know that we overfeel in all directions. What is that? We compare inside against our outside. We don't really know how they're feeling about that. That's how our emotional thing is. So now we come down. Don't drink a day at a time. Abstinence. Abstinence is a spiritual environment. It isn't really natural for alcoholics not to drink, but as long as you and I have abstinence, we have a chance. And we sit here and we cannot help but we identify. Right on, why didn't I say it, Paul? Right on what he said, what she said, Jesus Christ. And you know, we have this identification. And then there's something even deeper than that is called moments of clarity. Moments of clarity. What is that? I take my 10th and 11th step one night and I said, "God, why was I so lucky that I saw and grabbed and ran with it? Why didn't my brothers, they needed as much as I did?" How many people have you and I tried to 12 step to do want what we got? It's incredible. And then 45 years sober, I have to go to five meetings a week, and I'm just sick. I have to go to five. I can't listen to that goddamn chapter five another time. I have it up to here. And then I reflect. In 45 years, I haven't had one person coming from outside and said, "It's terrific." It's a disaster. So I go to a meeting with a bad attitude, and I sit down in the meeting, and I hear precisely what I needed to hear. Thank God I was here. Think I wasn't being missed out on it. Thank God I was here. So I come home. You know, ladies and gentlemen, my wife is a writer. And she wrote in one of her stories, "To be loved is sure like living in a state of grace. It's here in abundance in every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and Olive." And it's a beautiful thing. You know, to me, the moments of clarity in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the music in AA. So you all knew, do this, do what we do. Don't drink and come to meetings. It's the best deal in town. Thank you.